Lyle Harris. Yeah, beautiful. Maybe we'll bring Lyle back to do one last piece when it's all over to take us home with. Yeah. Not that I'm going to read anything, but ready for Don. You've heard Howard, and you could hear a whole bunch of poets sing the praises of Don Finkel, who, when I first came to St. Louis in 1967, he was kind of the headman of the tribe of poets here, and he remains the respected headman of the poets' tribe in St. Louis. Touch poets as a teacher, but I think that his authority as a teacher not only comes from his compassion and sensitivity to bringing out people's own voices rather than imposing anything on them, but also from the standard of excellence and a sense of experimentation in his own work. He's published many books. Some of the titles that stand out are The Clothing's New Emperor, Simeon, Answer Back, The Garbage Wars, wonderful double book, Endurance and Going Under, What Manner of Beasts, terrific translations of contemporary Chinese poets. I think it was called Splintered Mirror. Yeah. Some poems in a lyrical mode, some in a narrative mode, some extended book-length narratives, some depending on experimental strategies of collage or documentary strategies. A really rounded poet who's really been all over the gamut of the possibilities of poetic expression, and been good at anything he puts his hand to. So you always know you're going to hear some good poems when Don reads. So he came through for us once again tonight, and we're thrilled to have him here, and we're fortunate to hear Don Finkel.
It may be okay now. Okay, that's it. For those of you who came here to hear David Meltzer, what can I say? I'm sorry. It wasn't my fault. For which reason I'm going to read as a first poem, The Imposter. I am the original cat of nine lives, excuse the glove, doppelganger to the man with seven wives, who was too busy wifing it up in St. Ives to come and explain. I am doppelganger to any man with a life or a wife, high, wide, and handsome enough to hold me. I fly my own plane. I may show up in Milwaukee at any hour, remember St. Ives. May their God have mercy on the men of Milwaukee and their wives. It's one life or the other, the same five flying senses, same heart, same liver, same tongue, sweetbreads, gizzard, clatter and wheezing, past rhyme, past reason, one span of springs and winters to listen to what the pieces are saying to each other. If the lights go out, we'll fly by candlelight, If the elm trees die, we'll bang behind the billboards. May the God of the mills have mercy tomorrow on the men of Chicago. I have an excuse, I guess, since I'm that early in my book, to read an even earlier couple of poems. Gee, that moves by itself. It's like a snake. This is a fairly early poem, but it begins to come true all over again. It's a poem called Give Way. Give way to the man coming at you. He is probably organized, or he is a mason. So much the worse for you. The child ahead of you walks carefully, does not step on a crack. She knows. Keep close to the buildings. Stick to the well-lit avenues. Give way. Man that is born of woman is of few days and full of trouble. He cometh forth like a flower and is cut down. He fleeth also as a shadow and continueth not. Your path will be covered with cracks. Beware of a tall man who will bring ill fortune. Beware of a short man. He will be armed. Or better yet, organize. Call meetings. Make speeches. Pay dues. With the dues, acquire a public address system and make louder speeches. Cast ballots. Win. If you will notice now, the tall man, he tests the microphones. The short man ensures with his gun the collection of dues. Everyone is stepping between the cracks. However, nobody is fully satisfied. Keep close to the buildings. Give way. The man coming at you may be armed. I didn't know what I was writing at the time, but I'm beginning to figure it out. Since Howard introduced you to his angels, I thought I might read a couple of my angel poems. I've always been sort of interested in angels, but in a rather perverse way. The angel I finally came up with as my angel is called Lame Angel. Now let me introduce him to you this way. Lame Angel slumps at his desk. His basket is empty, but his hand clasps and unclasps the indifferent air like an embryo practicing its grip. Like an embryo, he practices everything. Swimming, creeping, chinning himself on the cord, even flying in place. Under his shirt, his downy shoulder blades throb like a deer's first horns. He scrapes them against his chair. Sometimes, in high places, he goes to use them, as a one-legged man might run from a burning house. He'll die before they sprout. Clenched in his teeth, perhaps a morsel of wind, a worm rehearsing perpetually the life of a butterfly, but a worm to the end. Well, this one is a little obscene, but what the hell. It's called Some of the Shots Will Make You Gasp Aloud. He sits in his window, grinding his groin with his horny fists, leafing through batches of lust and snatch and naked mother. Lame Angel has exhausted the tireless go-go girls. He is learning to read. how just in days you can acquire the hidden secrets of 5,000 years of ruthless terror, from the merciless Nahuatlian Indians to the foot fighters of the French underworld. Free, 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 free. Try the fantastic French extension. Flips open instantly and locks automatically to prevent accidental closing. Razor sharp, tough, stainless, over 200 pages on the pleasures of pain. One more from Lame Angel. It's called New Leaf. Patron of alley cats and suicides, Lame Angel has applied for a government grant. A folder of letters, clippings, a list of good works in triplicate. He is learning to smile, not a good smile, the smile of a cripple, though he has little cause to complain. Good health, good teeth, a reasonable living, and Lord knows all angels were not created equal. And from these earlier poems, one last that occurred to me just before I came. It was an oracle. It's called Oracle. It is I, Orpheus, speaking through a mouthful of dust. To hell with Apollo. I can keep still no longer. Listen, Finkel, stop piecing me together in your bounding iambics. Besides, you read too much. The tune the stones will dance to is not in the books. Inside, your wife is sleeping with fine, long legs, whom Hades has not yet noticed. While there is time, get off your ass and make the most of her. I wanted to read one poem that I think is appropriate for this place because the fellow involved even used to play here. He was a blind pianist named Bobby Betts. And this poem is a poem about Bobby, who, of all terrible things to happen to a piano player and a drunk, got drunk one night in Springfield and fell asleep on the coldest day of the year and got frostbite in all his fingers. When he returned from rehab, he was sort of crippled in the fingers and stayed at our house. This poem is called Piano Man, and it's about that time. Thanks, man, he mumbles as the cabbie relinquishes his arm, flashing over his shoulder that incorrigible blind man's smile, a parting shot, then turns it on me and reaches out his hand. Clenched around something I can't hope to see, the blunt, frost-blackened fingers graze my palm, stiff but oddly civil, a manicured claw. 2 years ago, coldest night of the year, coming home from a two-bit taproom gig, the smile froze to his face like a mask of ice. Snow lay round so thick he couldn't raise a peep from the pavement with his radar stick. A block to the left and two and a half to the right, then he curled in an alley and slept the sleep of the numb between 9 jiggers of whiskey and the weather. Lighting up now, He clamps his cancer stick close to the tip to steady it for the flame, incense of smoldering flesh. Can't work his zipper, asks me, can I wait while he fishes it out and dribbles over his shoes to zip him up. Hard luck pounded a rolling bass on his bones, but didn't he ramble through the difficult changes? And doesn't he parry my question with the same damned smile? Look, man, blindness is the least of my problems. It may, even in Poetry Month, which is what April is, starting with April Fool's Day, this is the first Poetry Month of in the world, anyway, for the United States. This poem is about the fact that there may be more poets than we really need. The poem is called The Dismal Science. Actually, that refers to economics, but it applies. Like hogs in Iowa sometimes, too much of it now, and no one's buying. Oh, it smelt so of promise. The great trucks reeked of it, sows bursting with faro, the city clamoring, the prices soaring. In the guts of the city, a young man hunches over a kitchen table, scribbling. His freezer's crammed with bittersweet elegies, low-salt epigrams, poems breed in his larder. He goes on scribbling. He could pick up an epic in the this morning from the takeaway rack at the local supermarket. All over the city, young men are scribbling, and old women, and school children, and several chimpanzees. The young man persists in his kitchen, parboiling a dithyramb, while the sows go on farrowing in Iowa. Welcome to the 11th plague, plenty. There's room enough in here for everyone. Well, yeah, if I could retire, but I'm not fully retired yet, as you can see. I know. If I can only find it in here. I made a whole bunch of little markers, but I can't find that one. Here it is. It's called The Invention of Strangers. Robert Ardrey, who's a rather peculiar cuss, wrote a book called The Social Contract. And I rather was interested in this one quotation, which is the epigraph of this poem. He says, "The prime foundation for the future of civil violence must be the invention of strangers. Once you've got strangers, you've got a chance to really start fights." That was my addition. He quit while he was winning. This is the poem that followed that comment of his. In the ancient perpetual war between self and non-self, there's enmity everywhere. No need to invent it. Young blacks cruising the boulevards in battered Cadillacs, old Jews debouching from storefront synagogues in green-black overcoats and Assyrian beards, squatters, parvenus, barbarous, suspect, unaccountable. Nor are there always so simple to distinguish from non-competence or friends. Even the dust is a stranger, crowding every aperture. Any moment, some fanatical antibody might trigger a massacre, transports of savagery, spasms of slaughter, clammy with shock, seething from scalp to soles, the ghetto gasps for breath. Somewhere under a mountain of outworn inventions, warriors are sleeping, imperturbable torpor, shoulders lapped in epaulets of dust. Somewhere deep in the bowels of the city, a shadow slips from a doorway, cradling a shapeless burden, a weapon, an infant, a bundle of rags. Somewhere a baffled sentry bawls out, "Who goes there?" The title of this poem is "The Kindly Ones," and I was fascinated to discover the Eumenides. The translation of Eumenides is "The Kindly Ones," who are also the Furies, who chased they chased almost anybody who did any nasty thing, and without pause, just chased them straight into hell and kept chasing them thereafter. They were called the Kindly Ones, I think, to kind of placate them. It was a kind of flattery, but of course you know that gets you nowhere. This is called "The Kindly Ones," and it's about some kindly ones who are still after us. Streaming from Erebus through a crack in the pavement, they crowd the door to the abortion clinic. Older than Zeus, in Ilium, every beggar had one to keep him honest. Under their lavender pantsuits, coal black breasts, bat wings, leathery shanks, thorny scourges in their turquoise purses to chasten the prodigals sidling to slaughter. Among us as ever, they chide the infanticides past the threshold of shadows, brandishing blissful conviction and raspberry smiles, counseling chastity, poverty, a term of virtuous labor, then age on age of sackcloth and vain remorse. They're still with us, kindly as ever. This one is called "When We Open the Door," and it's about one of the many cats we've had in our lives. I realize that every time, and it doesn't change anything, every time you get a pet, you're married to death, because the pet is sure to die before you do, and you're sure to love her or him with all the power in which you love your children. And you're going to have to face it. This is just called "When We Open the Door." Skeletal, draggled, a rough draft of a cat, distended dugs betokening a litter of moribund kittens under somebody's porch. When we opened the door that day, love crept in too, who reigned for years, every inch the queen, purring long-drawn doxologies of breath, wetting her claws on our benevolence. When we opened the door that day, grace crept in too, who lay of a morning supine on a pallet of sunlight, four paws to heaven, licking herself into shape, dreaming her undulant way into old age. when we opened the door that day, peace crept in too. Draped tranquilly on the doctor's stainless table, liquor of oblivion trickling through her veins, she sighs one final sutra and sends us away. When we opened the door that day, death crept in too. This last summer, we probably spent our last time in a long, long time in Mexico. So we may not be going back there right away. And I wanted to read a couple of poems from the time I spent in Mexico. We used to have a house there till we just got rid of it. And this is a poem about, I can hardly believe that I was born in the Bronx, in a kind of middle crummy neighborhood. I ended up with a gardener. We weren't there all the time, but he kept the garden when we were away, came three times a week while we were there and while we were away. And it was really his garden, not mine. And his name was Arcadio, Arcady, which was absolutely appropriate. And he was probably the hardest thing for us to leave in all of Mexico was Arcadio. And this is a poem about Arcadio. It's called The Gardener. And this is actually true. When I asked Arcadio to name me the trees around the area in Spanish, he named them all. And then I said, well, what about that tree? And he said, árbol, which means tree. I said, wait a minute, what's the name of the tree? I know it's a tree. And this is all in Spanish. And he said, no, it's árbol. That's what we call it. Obviously, it had no other name. It was a pure tree. Arcadio says that tree's called tree. That perennial drooping over its falling crimson petals, he calls permanent. He can translate the leaves of the bougainvillea, the hieroglyphs on the aphid's wing, the runes the ant inscribes on the honey mesquite. Walking an intransigent flagstone into place, ill-favored piece of a clumsy puzzle, he improvises as he goes, building a crazy pavement for our shoes. Green hummingbirds creak like tiny doors in the fitful breeze. The mesquite needs cutting back, he smiles. Wrestling a thorny, sawed-off, six-foot branch, he tears a spray off the fuchsia. Face down, it's pressing its limp, lanceate leaves against the bricks, while its mother grieves, tolling her magenta bells. Now he eases the root-bound patience from her pot and sets her in a fresh-turned bed, old embers for new urns, scatters a fistful of compost from his gunny sack, redistributing the earth, then bathes her feet. We need more earth, senor, Arcadio says, three burros of compost, two of loam. He weighs in his palm a lump of sun-dazed clay, pale, dense, obdurate as death. In all our books, there is no name for it. Three mornings a week, his key turns in the lock and sets our day in motion. Then two enchanted hours exalting the ivy, exorcising the weeds, rites of the paring knife, sacraments of bucket and hose. Coming to say goodbye, he drops a rosebud on my page, an eloquent period swathed in moss-green sepals. From the ravaged tip a corpse-white rose grub cranes, its life work likewise interrupted. Here's why they do not bloom. His eyes, twin flames of passionate attention, he turns to take his leave, bearing in his hand both bud and worm. He's kneeling in the rain again, weeding the geraniums, dividing the waters from the waters, the darkness from the light. His smile rides out our protests like a glistening keel. One drop winks on his forelock. Bright rivulets trickle from his fingers toward ecstatic roots. On his way back with a pocket full of nails, he pauses to reconsider the view, the town cascading beneath him onto the plateau, the fields of early corn, the fruitless plains. He has been training the trumpet vine. Returning, he spies one impertinent creeper sidling among the geraniums. Reproachfully, he tugs it free and stands it against the wall. Called from his task neither by scorn nor praise, eyes fixed on the nail head, utterly contained within the boundaries of his skin, he hears his bones ring at the hammer blows. And one more to Mexico. It's just called So Long. And then I'm going to read one endless poem. Not endless, no. This one is not really a book-length poem, I promise you. But this one is Goodbye to Mexico, at least for a while. So long. The mesquite sadly waves his thousand pods like parchment yellow, knobbed, arthritic fingers in the same breeze that riffles his gray-green beard, as if for the first time now he realizes how enchanting I am in my pale blue bark and impetuous roots, scurrying aimlessly over the flagstones like a demented ant. How dull it will be when I'm gone, with nothing to watch but lizards and hummingbirds, with nothing to do but snooze in the August sun, dazed by cicada calls and Sunday bells, as if only now he sees how beguiling are my comings out and goings in, how meticulously I vein my cloud-white leaves, how much he missed me even while I was here. And finally, to change the scene enormously, I spent a summer in Maine on the coast, and I was right on the edge of a tidal river. And I grew up in New York, the Hudson is a tidal river, but I paid no attention. It takes me a long time to learn these things. There's nothing more exciting than a tidal river. It comes and it goes, unlike other rivers which just go. And when it went for a while, it would leave behind it, just below the cliff on which we were perched, with a kind of stony beach, which you could also call a shingle. I decided I liked the word shingle better. This poem is called On the Shingle, and it's about that time in Maine. And it's a sequence of things, and it just kind of runs through them. Maybe it's one of those attempts to try to invent a new way of writing. It rambles into prose, into more poetic and less poetic passages, as you'll see. Below on the shingle, a man's skipping pebbles. Gravely they wait at his feet for another go-round of scouring and burnishing. Slabs of sea-worn granite, slate leaves, stemless, iridescent, bruised gold wafers, shards of sea glass, garnet, amethyst, a mild, complacent, saintly rabble sunning themselves in the nakedness of their imperfections. Everywhere he turns on this stony beach, the tide affords, between the pine wood and the briny, collops and lozenges, arrowheads and amulets leap to his hand and hurl themselves at Odom's ledge. A moment there, I would have sworn that one was walking on water. High above, the pine wood, abiding, balsam and oak mold, boletus, armillaria, agaric, inky cap, a nameless lime green moss like the froth of chaos, corpse pale Indian pipe that blackens at the touch, the hemlock branch swinging shut on my passage like a frail green gate. The eons have beaten a door in the upthrust slate the tide saunters through on his way out. A brooding lintel, a threshold of dingy granite, I'd just as soon sit on as step over. Tide still lapping the threshold while sunlight toe dances on a doormat of bladder rack. Tide's going out, kicking their petticoats, the white caps can-can on Odom's ledge, as Odom rises from his six-hour soak with his eight sunbathing harbor seals and 14 cormorants hanging their dark, tragicomical wings to dry. Half the day, it's the tide's turn, half the day, mine. Going or coming, or what's a doorway for? Beyond the door, the empery of seaweed, greeny brown furs on the pubes of Atlantis, patches of beach grass, sprays of sea lavender, three orphan pools where nothing swims, an osprey circling, circling high, and huddled on the underslung lip of the bluff, an oak tree cradling in the crook of one root the book of slate. Boulder squats in the water like a fat old Buddha, nothing showing but the top of his shaven pate. Erratic zazen, up to his elbows in silt, he's leading the simple life. Twice daily zits baths, plenty of sunlight, moonlight, fresh salt air, and both feet firmly planted in the grave. 6 hours from now, he'll rise, renewed, a crown of rockweed on his feldspar-freckled dome, just another igneous hobo passing through, down by the river, waiting for the Ice Age local, flanked by mile on mile of homeless Buddhas, lining both shores, shawls of seaweed round their shoulders, prayer mats of weed. Wind has his own agenda. A supercharged tangerine jolly boat rips down the silence like a self-propelled chainsaw. Trough on trough, wavelet after wavelet, cross and recross, as deep in its dream, the river whimpers. The boulders croon to it in unison, mile on mile. Back of every Buddha, a tranquil pool rocking in a seaweed cradle. Love comes to this, a long while resting side by side like mica-flecked erratics varnished with light, like mossy boulders between asleep and asleep, as cliff and tide spin out their conversation. As a cormorant takes off into the wind, dark seraphim beating the water with his wings. Lobsterman's dog barks at a loose two-pounder thrashing the foredeck. Hauling traps, the lobsterman barks back, their voices tossed on the landward breeze like gnats of sound. We're all of us hard at it here. A cormorant retraces the arc of the lobster boat's wake, checking for discards as the lobsterman works downriver to check his next trap. Beside me, an ant's dismantling the cliff, single-handed. Toes working in the earth, naked but for the gray-green crown of leaves, a brawny oak poses at the brink for a swan dive onto the shingle. Even daylight's working its way through the windward doorpost as the doorway opens, grain by grain by grain. Tide thrusts his salty tongue down the river's throat. The incoming tide's brushing the shingle widdershins, laving the continent's broken toes. In time, the tide relents, and the cliff in its own time, between the shingle, grounds of their accord, a little sweetness trickles into the bay. Sails furled, a white two-master laboring seaward against the tide, while running before the wind, a sister passes upriver, tip of her full-bellied spinnaker quivering with pleasure. Crossing Slate City, tenements of slate, slate black backlots teeming, slate graveyards, middens of slate, in praise of all things, frangible, mutable, fugitive, shattered, weathered, worn, or torn, in praise of cracks, fractures, great rifts, infinitesimal fissures, ablation, transience, and decay. I pause to piss on the shingle, my thimbleful of inglorious acid. Tourist waves from a rubberneck launch, and I, by Jiminy, I wave gravely back. Far beyond the door, where the cliff leans down to the shingle, lie outposts of beach grass and sea lavender, though the piney slope is bare of both. Behind a tatter of fluttering rockweed, a spot of turbulence wrinkles the skin of stillness, as cliff and tide rock to and fro between frailty and passion, systole and diastole, and the seal lies down with the cormorant on Odom's toe. To whom it may concern, I leave this carton of fossils, this shingle museum, all things shed, shattered, weather-bitten, out at elbows, worn to the bone, cast off, dislocated, dispersed in an endless, blissful diaspora. One muscle shell undone, blue robe eroding in folds from a pearly shoulder, one shiver of milk-blue bottle glass, the once cruel edges softly blunted, one wafer of white pine lumber, cleanly sawn. Yet nothing wholly dead. The barnacles refuse to loose their hold. The lichens breathing still on its tatter of bark. And the spray of sea lavender. Shrouded in slate, the iron's not done rusting. One spruce cone sprouting on a twig like a minikin thyrsus one crab carapace on its back, a brooding burnt sienna Buddha face. I can hear the seals tuning up on Odom's thigh, the gulls yee-haw straddling a vagrant gust, and my lungs fill with the turbulence of his passage. Down here, between one solitude and the next, love comes to this, to nothing but this. Thank you.